What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning into the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, and I have another hot show for you today. On the phone with me, I have a very gifted and prolific music composer who has worked with some of the biggest names in the music business, from Liza Minnelli to B.B. King, Patty Austin, and Take Six. He is a musical genius when it comes to composing and arranging and defining the sound for every band that he directs. Please put your hands together and welcome producer, composer, arranger, and keyboardist, Michael Labeni. How's it going, Michael?
Good. Great to be on the show, Spud. Thank you.
Oh.
I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you so much, man. It's truly an honor to have you here, Michael. I mean, you've been in the game a long time. Your compositions are timeless. And again, the honor is mine. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, Mike, again, you've been in the business a long time, writing compositions that are just mind-blowing. And, you know, one of the compositions that I know you're involved with was with Linus and Lucy with Mr. David Benoit. Oh,
yeah.
Man, that is probably one of my favorite cuts of all time. You know, this is dating back back in around 87, 88 when I first heard the tune.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was automatically familiar just watching the Charlie Brown cartoons. But with the twist that you guys added on it was so contemporary. I mean, it just became a very likable commercial song that they played on the radio play at the time. And when I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I mean, we had a jazz station and they played that all the time. And there's just so many things I love about the song. One thing I want to point out is, you know, during the song, I mean, everyone's hearing the main riff, but probably towards the middle, you guys put a twist, adding those major 7/9 chords.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what really stuck out to me. I'm a huge fan of major 7/9 and minor 7/9 chords, and I use a lot of those chords in my own playing and compositions. And you know, just to have that in the Linus and Lucy was amazing.
Well, that was that whole project was really a lot of fun because you know, first of all, the characters are universal.
Yes.
So no matter where you are in the world, you knew the characters, and it was really fun working with the different artists, and everybody kind of put their own thoughts into it, and, you know, I kind of oversaw everything, and I think I wrote maybe 3 or 4 of the arrangements, and kind of oversaw the different possibilities, and it was great, you know, because you have so many different personalities you're working with. You're working with the David Benoit, you're working with the B.B. King, you're working with Chick Corea, you're working with Joe Williams, so it was, and the Patty Austin, of course.
Yes.
So you really, it was just a lot of fun, and the good thing about it, from my point of view and from the record companies, is that it crossed over sort of into a pop chart area. So the record sales are really terrific on it. And it's still a fun record. In fact, when you mention it, I hadn't heard the project in a long time. I put it on the other day. It was fun listening to it again. It was really a lot of fun, and especially the track with B.B. King, who I enjoyed working with so much, not only on that, but we worked together on the GOP Big Band CD also, and he's just a joy. Everybody was really a joy to work with. Joe Williams was wonderful, and, you know, Chick, everybody. So it was really, you know, just from beginning to end, it was a lot of fun, a lot of different variations on the themes, as you heard.
Yes.
So it's a fun project, really.
Oh, it's got to be. You know, working with those legends amongst yourself, I mean, that's got to just be an experience, and you still think about it from time to time, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, it was great. Like I said, it was fun listening to those, because I have a tendency when I'm finishing a project, whether it's a recording or an arrangement, it's kind of leaves my head, and I never, it's like suddenly listening to a stranger's music, you know, I just kind of, my head separates from the project immediately. So it's really strange for me, but even when I'm working on like projects now, when I go to see the scores at a rehearsal, it's like, who wrote this? You know, I have to kind of get my head back into it because there's so much going on that it's just interesting to listen to some of the old stuff. I'm funny about that because I'm so self-critical about what I do that once I finish a thing, I'm saying, oh, thank God, that's over. My God, I hope it's okay. You know, I really have the panic attacks.
Well, I'm a keyboardist also, and you definitely have my stamp of approval. I mean, because these are one of the songs that I practice and play from time to time a lot, again, because of a lot of the chord changes with the major 7/9s, and it's an A major. I love playing an A, you know, too. So, you know, it's just one of those songs I just immediately gravitated to, and if I'm just warming up doing chops, I mean, I find myself playing it just because it's melodic, it feels good, and you know, just the possibilities where you could take it is just endless, in my opinion.
Well, you know, I also like working with, you know, kind of messing with the harmony. Basically, there are no sacred cows when I work. So it's like I really like taking the harmony some other directions. And that was one of the other things that was fun, is that the artist kind of really left the traditional harmonic approach to some of these pieces on the side and just really put their own touches in, which is really, to me, what it's all about, either as a player, certainly as an arranger, composer. I love kind of going a little left to center and creating, you know, just creating a whole different, what's the word I'm looking for, aura maybe, or a whole different setting for the piece.
Yes, well, it definitely showed on that track, definitely.
That was great.
You know, how did you start, Michael, as a musician and then merging into a composer and arranging for other musicians and bandmates, you know, around the world?
Well, you know, I started, my family was kind of musical. My father was like a Freddie Green type of guitar player, and I had an aunt who played piano, like a boogie-woogie and stride piano. A lot of music in both sides of the family. Always played and got together and partied two or three days and just played and danced, and I just got interested very young. I was born in Brooklyn originally, and then I moved out to Farmingdale, Long Island, where I became fascinated by my high school band, and I just spent my summers, like, just I'm self-taught, basically, as a writer and as a player. So I wanted to join my high school band, but I couldn't read music that well, so that summer I just spent the summer in my house practicing sight reading, and before I just started to write. The fascination of, for me, as a writer, is like a jigsaw puzzle. I just fascinated me how the instruments make them sound and to create the colors, like what I heard Ellington do and Gil Evans, and, you know, and even going back as far as the Fletcher Henderson charts for Benny Goodman, because I was a big Chet Wilson fan. And at 15, I was starting to write and play professionally already. So that was, and I always played with older musicians, which was the best education you could get.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, it was really fortunate in that sense. And got into doing studio work, and it was just a gradual evolution where, you know, I played keyboard on a lot of sessions, but also wrote a lot of sessions. So it was just a wonderful experience. Really a learning process. When I was younger, I just used to write. If I heard a rehearsal band, I just used to write and just bring the music and hear it. If it was 10 sousaphones, I'd write something for 10 sousaphones just to hear it played.
Sure.
That's, you know, it's one thing. Let people get the feedback. So that's the important thing, you know.
You know, we shared the same traits there, Michael. You know, I started playing and recording music at a very young age also. When I was about 14 is where I really started recording music and composing my own tracks and things. And, you know, it's funny you brought up the color of the sound, the characteristics of certain patches and instruments. Immediately when you hear it, you just want to start writing to it. It's like, wow, I hear that tone. I could do something with that. And, you know, listen to records at a very young age. I just kind of felt that's where my niche was.
Yeah.
As a composer, producer, and especially as a keyboardist, you know, which brings me into the evolution of keyboards. I know that you're a keyboardist, man, and I definitely got to talk to you about when keyboards came out, how were you using them, and, you know, where they've evolved today. I mean, do you see certain trends, or do you feel like it's just this huge transformation of sonic quality that we have now versus back in the day? Because a lot of guys now are using some of these old Juno 106s and the Jupiter sounds I hear a lot. So,
no, that's funny. Because when it first came out, one of my first keyboards was, the keyboard Ray Charles plays on What I'd Say. One of my things, isn't that terrible? I totally blanked on the keyboard. And it had this really individual sound, as did the Fender at one point. And it was just, I enjoyed playing it. The thing I had, I would play more keyboards on dates than I did live. So I was really, when I did play keyboards, it was really on either record dates or for commercials. But it was funny for me. The first problems I had was the weighted action syndrome. I couldn't get used to that's really like almost no force, no resistance on the action.
Yeah, no weighted keys.
That was funny. Yeah, you know, some of those keyboards. Now, of course, I have a nice Technics keyboard here. I basically write on it. I don't even really play gigs on it, but I write on it. I love the weighted action. So that to me, but I think it's amazing. I think the whole use of the keyboards can be wonderful. I mean, I throw nothing away like that. I think it's all important. It's not what you do, really. It's how you use the instrument. And really, you know, you can use an acoustic piano and make it sound ugly. It's how you do it. It's really how you do it. And some people like McCoy Tyner, I don't believe has really ever recorded, or if he has, it's been a limited. But then you get like Chick and Herbie. And guys like that who've made, you know, even Bill Evans is recorded on Fender. So it's still the person who's playing it and what their creative mind does with that particular instrument, me. So I love playing it. I just don't really, when I do play in person, it's usually on acoustic piano.
Right.
But what can I tell you?
No, I agree. You know, but it, like you said, it really goes back to the style of playing. Because for me, I'm one of the players who, I don't prefer weighted keys. just for my style of playing as a keyboardist, I love the non-weighted keys just because I do a lot of slides and, I love my pitch bend. I got to have a pitch bend.
Okay. No, that's cool. But again, it's how you use all of these effects.
Definitely.
You know, that's the thing. It's how you do it, you know, and that's what makes the music.
Definitely. You know, with all the recordings that you've done, Michael, you know, I got to talk about your analog experience and now merging over to the DAW world of recording. Are you still on the analog format, going to 2-inch tape, or are you transferred over to the DAW world of recording? Because there's a lot of guys that I talk to still prefer the tape. So.
No, I started off in analog, that was an experience, I'd say, because, you know, when I started recording with 4 tracks, and then when it became 8 tracks, guys said, wow, we got 8 tracks, what are you going to do with 8 tracks? And then we managed to fill that up, then it got to 16 and so forth. It was like every time it graduated, you know, you'd say, oh, man, you got 16 tracks, what are we going to do with 16? We'll never use them. So, and as you know, what happened, you know, what's happened now in the whole business, it's great. But I don't miss the 2-inch tape, I tell you. I do like certain kind of music. I think analog is better than digital, but I really not crazy about when we used to have to edit tapes together, man. That was, oh my god. And also when we'd work on a project, you know, you'd order like 16, 20 reels of tape, and then that's the cost would go crazy when you're trying to work within a budget. You know, you have, and then you have to carry, you ship all these big boxes of tape. I don't really miss that part of it, to be honest with you.
Sure.
I don't really miss this part. But at certain times, it's analog, I think it's a certain sound. If you're doing more of maybe an acoustic sound, like a big band or something like that, sometimes that might be better. It's, again, you know, a lot of the wonderful engineers like Al Schmidt and James Farber, you know, they all have their ways of doing things. And it's, again, it's how you hear the music. It's really how you hear the music.
I agree. You know, I love the analog tone. You know, I love the hot signal that we can, you know, kind of saturate the sound. But
right.
You can't compromise the editing functionality of DAWs. I mean, especially for doing vocals and parts. The cut and paste alone is, you know, definitely a time saver.
Oh my God! I remember when I was doing commercials in like the 1960s and 1970s. You know, we still had we had the old moviolas too, and they were like, you know, dinosaurs. And invariably, when I had a post score, I'd be up like 2 a.m. and of course the film would split. And there I am, like in the first 2 hours, like 2 hours, just trying to edit this moviola together, man. It was, oh, that part I don't miss. You know, those certain things like that, when things, whether it's tape or the, you know, tape on the recording end or tape on the moviola, boy, I don't miss that part of it when it would break and I have to sit there and splice everything.
Yeah.
But that's, I don't miss that at all.
What DAW recorder are you using now? Pro Tools, Logic, or Nuendo, or?
Well, PD Pro Tools, and that's what they use. You know, I'm the musical director of the WDR radio big band in Cologne, Germany, since 2003. So, they, you know, at first when I got there, I don't think they use Pro Tools, but now they do use the Pro Tools. And I find it's you know, it's great. You know, it's a great tool. I really think it's great. And they've gotten better using it at the company where I am in Cologne, where they have their own, you know, own studio, and they've got some brand new equipment in there, and their editing process has gotten better even since I've been there in 2003. So nice. I'm very happy with that now.
Oh, definitely. You know, with all the preamps that you can run in externally to the converters on the HD9-2 rigs, like I said, the sound's not compromised, and, you know, the editing functions are there, so you can't go wrong.
I know. It's different. You know, you got to work with different people. There's certain engineers I loved working with. And, you know, they make it easy for this guy in New York, Josiah Gluck, who I think he's still doing the Saturday Night Live show. And we did a lot of work on GRP records together. As James Farber and as Al Schmidt and as Bernie Kirsch, who has been Chick Corea's sound person for years. We worked together a lot with GRP. And there's certain guys, Don Murray, also out on the West Coast, a wonderful engineer. So, I mean, there's certain engineers you really kind of lock in with as a producer that you really enjoy working with. You don't have, I like when you don't have to say 1,000 things to them. You know, I like it when they kind of get the feel. We kind of get the initial feeling together, and then I let them do what they have to do, and then make my comments.
Yeah, I agree. Sonically, man, like you know, you get a nice engineer who knows your production sonically, you know, aside from melodically, the structure and harmonically, but they really understand where your sounds fit within the mix. And, you know, if you have somebody consistently, you guys really develop that relationship together. So, yeah, I agree with you.
Some of the things the hardest, I think, is balancing, I found, with some engineers, not the ones I mentioned, but balancing the voice against either a big band or an orchestra or electronically based group. Sometimes they have a tendency to, you know, to put the voice either too far up front or too far buried in the track. There is a happy medium in there, and if that's, to me, I think that's the hardest. When I've done work with singers, is to get that proper sound. When I work with when it's a situation like with Patty Austin, when we did the Yvonne Gershwin album, you know, her putting, you know, well, they did that out in the West Coast with Don Murray, putting her voice in a spot. It was an acoustic band and some strings, but putting that voice in the proper spot where you really hear, you know, you hear every lyric, every note, and you hear what's going on. And but it's balanced within. You also don't lose the band, you know, because some people will have a tendency. I found engineers who don't have the experience of working with, say, an acoustic band or an orchestra have a tendency to put the voice so out front and bury the band or the orchestra, which I really don't like.
Yeah.
As an arranger, you know, my ego gets hurt. I'm like, come on, man, I worked so hard getting this nice sound and I can't hear anything.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I think a good mix, you know, we try to achieve the livest sound possible. You know, without it sounding studio process too much, is to capture that live essence of you really being at, you know, at the concert and, you know, having that translate over to speakers. That's the ultimate goal. And like I say, sometimes we fall off. We're not writing levels hard enough, and maybe we're pushing a little bit too hard, you know. So just like, you know, learning how to use those proper compression tools and limiter tools, you know.
it's a really fascinating process, you know. I really, especially the mix process, because I really like to sit and listen to what the engineer is doing, and really, I mean, I feel when you get to the mix process, a lot of times he's doing really most of the work, and you're kind of like, you know, putting in your two cents, like you're doing, like, oh, you know, like a little comp bass, you do a little plunk here and a little plunk there, and just kind of add what you need to add. Because I work with Phil Ramone as an arranger, and it's interesting to watch somebody like Phil work. You know, really, I like watching Tommy LaPuma, so it's interesting working with people like that and knowing them. And I remember when Phil Ramone, when I was a kid playing dates when it was an A&R recording studio, it was in New York before Phil became a producer, so to speak. So besides, you know, creating a lot of interesting things on his own, being an original as an engineer and creating a lot of different situations, he also became a hell of a producer. So really, I like doing that. And I'd like to get back into more producing. Most of my time has been spent with arranging and composing, which is fine. I have no problem with that. And playing on occasion. I've been playing more gigs in Europe than I have in the States, and I'm trying to get back into playing some gigs here, either solo piano things, or I've been doing some interesting duet playing with interesting horn players, or even an interesting singer, and excluding the rhythm section. So I'm not using bass or drums or guitar or anything. I kind of like the dangerous situation of being a solo, playing solo, and being able to kind of move around harmonically. Key changes and just suddenly throw in some other changes and expand bar lines. And so I'm finding it more interesting for myself like that, because I've never been a practicer.
Sure.
You know, when I practicing, when I got to the gig, it still didn't work. I figured, well, I'll give that idea up. Let me just sit down and play. Whatever comes out, that's it. You know?
Right, definitely. You know, speaking of production, Micah, I want to talk to you a little bit about production. You know, I found myself as a producer, my niche as a producer is where I can really build my compositions and production around pre-existing vocals that I might have recorded maybe 2-3 days before when the artist came in to record. You know, they hear a basic skeleton track, an idea of what it should be, and, you know, they lay down the lyrics. But after they leave, man, I really strip all the music down, and I start building my chord progressions and the rhythm arrangements and start picking my sounds that's going to fit well within the mix and not drown out the artists. And I just found that I was able to define their style on their own, who they are as an artist, versus just me giving you a track and you, you know, giving your best interpretation, what you would hear over it. You know, I just felt like those two combinations together really helped me as a producer. What would be your recommendations? What do you do as a producer when you're producing another artist, or maybe for an instrumentalist like a horn or a saxophone player or a guitarist?
Well, what we'd like to do is to kind of, first of all, look at the kind of material that they're performing. What kind of material? What's the direction of the sound? Then kind of work with them at a rehearsal and kind of go for a sound that we're kind of agreeing upon. Go into the studio, kind of sound-wise and groove-wise, find a spot where everything is kind of a pocket for it, basically. Finding that spot, sound, a pocket for the sound and a pocket for the groove, and just kind of build on that. And I don't care how long it takes, although I do have my limits as far as saying, okay, that's enough, guys. I think this is what it has to be. I found, as far as my satisfaction in getting the basics started, is that I think because of the fact that it's like, well, we can use 100 tracks because we can. I find that once I find a certain thing that I feel the groove is right, I tell the artist, okay, this is what I think we need to do. This is it. And because I found also that you can do 15 takes, and a lot of times I've come back to like my second or third take. I more or less try to find the spontaneity of it and then build on that spontaneity, for me, anyway. For me, I can't say this is a favorite way of working for a lot of people, but I like to build on that certain groove. Once I hit that, we kind of get the sound together with the engineer. That's it for me. And then, like, then we go to the next step, either the next piece, or then I do maybe say three pieces, just as an example. Then I'll take them home, and I'll really listen to them and start messing around with my keyboard here, just basic keyboard sounds, and just trying to fill in fine things. I start thinking in terms of orchestration, whether it's, you know, one horn, six keyboards, or whatever. It's still orchestration. Yes. It's still arranging. So I really got to find my pocket. I got to find the groove, first of all. And I want the soloist to be happy, obviously. And it's got to be a mutual thing. You know, I'm not the kind that want to do a lot of takes. So, because I think that's, I would rather save those lot of takes when we have, when we stop adding the other elements to it.
Sure.
It's funny because I'm coming from a situation where, like I said, when I came on the scene, you know, it was like, it was four tracks. So you're kind of thinking about some of that as you're into the 50th take sometimes. You're saying, well, come on, guys, we're missing the groove. We're losing the sound that we started with, both musically and groove-wise. We're missing something. We've got to go back and just sit and think about it and play. Sometimes I'll go on to another piece. You know, and then rather than hammer it to death, I really don't like to hammer the groove to death. I like to just settle in and then start thinking. In fact, while we're playing it, I'm already thinking of sounds. You know, whether it's, you know, we basically know the instrumentation that we're eventually going to wind up at. Like I said, it could be six keyboards, it could be whatever. As they're playing it, I'm already hearing things in my head that I know it's going to work. So I'm pre-orchestrating, you know.
Oh man, that's an excellent
I'm
method.
Writing the chart. But it's nice. I mean, we did something with one, in fact, a track with Joe Williams, which I didn't give you on the Charlie Brown record. Greg Fillinganes and I, and just a rhythm section, great rhythm section. Harvey Mason on drums, Neil Steubenhaus on bass, and a drummer played. He should play with Count Basie's band, Al Ahrens. But the tracks were all like thinking in terms of horns and brass. Brass and reeds. We played all these sounds, and when Joe came in to do the date, and it was a real groove. It was great, great sounds that Greg and I got. Well, really, Greg did. You know, just overseeing it. And then when Joe came in, he thought it was a real band because he was sick the day of the session, so he didn't know what was going on. So he came in about a week later, and he said, "Man, you got to write the chart. I want to use the chart for the Johnny Carson show." I said, "Well, I don't know how to tell you this, but it was all synths." And a live rhythm section. So what I had to do was very simple. I just took everything I wrote for the synths. It was written in terms of a band anyway. So it was very simple to take all the synth parts and just orchestrate it for live horns. So the sounds were so good and the groove was so good. Joe thought it was a real band. And wow. And I like it when people think that sometimes. You know, it's really, really fun. And the example on the Charlie Brown was that we had a lot of different engineers we were working with. So that was fun for me to work with different guys.
Wow.
So I'm observing how they all work and how they mix and how they go about the process. So it's really a lot of fun for me there. Wow. I mean, I like that.
You know, Mikey, you sound like you're definitely remaining a student of music. And, you know, I've considered myself a student of music always. And, you know, just it's always a constant learning process, you know, picking up other tricks and traits from other guys. And, you know, even if they have less experience, it could be one tool that they're using that's like, hey, man, I want to, you know, I'm going to implement that in my production methods and, you know, my structure. So, yeah, that's excellent.
No, I agree. Like I said, since I'm self-taught in that sense, when I say self-taught, I spend 29 hours a day. I'm still spending 29 hours a day learning about music and learning how to write. I mean, it's just never ending for me. But I think it's just a fascinating, existence for me. When I was a kid, there was nothing else I realized I wanted to do. You know, and I really pursued that. The band I played with the most was the Maynard Ferguson band, and I joined that when I was still a teenager and wrote a lot of charts for that band. Another learning experience, when I started doing commercials, the Beatles were still around, so a lot of stuff was Beatles-oriented, and a lot of rock, and I learned how to write the strings more. You know, so, I mean, there's this whole process that I went through that's just been wonderful. I mean, a lot of embarrassing moments, and every once in a while I still get an embarrassing moment or two. But again, you learn from those moments, you know. And so it's fun for me. It really is fun. I still feel the same fun and groove out of it all as I did when I was 15 years old. It never changed for me.
Sounds like it.
Really, man. I'm still like the Peter Pan of jazz or something, man.
You know, speaking of song arrangements, I want to talk to you a little bit about song measures. You know, typical pop R&B. You know, we have our 8-bar intro, 16-bar verse, 8-bar chorus. And mm-hmm. maybe merging into a bridge for 8 bars and going back to the verse again for 16 bars and then the outro. What are some of the more complex arrangements that you've done in your compositions that really went outside the box?
Well, I'm trying to think specifically, but I generally, I don't care if it's a funk track. We did a record with Maceo, the funk player, Maceo Parker, with the WDR band in Cologne. That was really a lot of fun. And even his basic funk tunes that were maybe 8 bars. I made them 9 bars or 13 bars. It's just, I have no problem with extending. I don't care what kind of music it is. I really don't care the genre, if it's a funk or an R&B or a jazz piece or whatever. I just have, even working with singers, just elongating phrases. I just don't hear things in even phrases. To me, when you start a phrase, and wherever that phrase ends, that's where it ends. If it ends at 8 bars, then it might end at 13 and a half bars. I have no problem doing that. If it makes musical sense, who cares? And the artists feel that way, too, because it feels organic. That's the thing. It really needs to feel organic to do that. I mean, there's things on the Gershwin album with Patty Austin I did, interesting things, I thought, you know, elongating phrases. When I've worked with Take Six, and that was really interesting because, you know, they have the beautiful 6-part harmony and the way they sound. Even still, I took what they did and he made it elongated phrases, and they were very cool with it because they felt comfortable with it. It's not like, you know, you don't want to feel like you're on your left foot all night. You know, you want to feel like, hey, man, this is working. And, you know, oh God, it's 13 and a half bars, but it didn't feel like it. Or it's 22 bars, or making an 8-bar phrase 13 bars. So who cares if it feels organically right? Doesn't make any difference to me.
I agree with you there because, you know, I wanted to bring that up because some of the compositions that are out there, like you said, it's the typical, you expect the change, you kind of predict it before it happens, you know. So, it has to fit well. And if it's really a good composition piece, you're not going to know if it's 16 bars or 17 because you're just really flowing with the song.
When the phrase ends, the phrase ends.
Yeah.
All right, it may end after 8 bars one time, then the next time around it might not, it might go longer. I just don't even think about it, to be honest with you.
Oh, that's true art, though. You know, we're out the box.
That's right. Then I stop and say, oh, wow, I didn't realize I did that. Oh, beautiful. Okay. And a lot of times I'll do, all of a sudden, it might be a 5-4 bar or a 7-4 bar within the phrase. And okay, so that's what it is.
Wow.
You know, the world is not all in 4-4.
That's true. I agree. It's a good starting point, good foundation to build, but there's more outside of it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's really interesting. I like writing in different time signatures. I wouldn't say, as a player, I haven't had the opportunity to play in those kind of time signatures, but I have no real major difficulty in writing in those time signatures. It's one thing to write it, and I have, even when I write in 4 or in 3, the way I write phrases, it sounds like it's somewhere, the bar someplace. You don't really know where the hell 1 is. Which is nice. I like that kind of feeling, too, where it's kind of suspended. No matter what kind of music you're playing, if you're playing with a funk band, where you kind of get this thing where you never really, it's kind of going over the bar and it's kind of moving along. You're just kind of caught up in the whole motion of the music. You're not realizing, oh, where's the 1? And then you say, wow, yeah, that's hip. And there's the 1. Okay, cool. How'd he get there? Okay, let's figure out how he got there. So that's fun to me.
Oh, that's excellent. what type of music inspires you outside of, your job-related music? You're writing for an artist. What kind of genre or music style really inspires you to get down and write and jam along with the song?
Wow. There's so many things. I mean, there were certain, certain rock tunes that inspired me, to certain funk tunes inspired me, Duke Ellington inspired me, Gil Evans inspired me, Bud Powell inspired me, the band Stuff inspired me, the Gad Gang inspired me, Bob Brookmeyer inspires me, and the Bartok String Quartets inspire me, there's so many things that that inspire me. I mean, really, I love it's just amazing. I'm still trying to figure out the Bartok String Quartets. I'm still trying to figure that orchestral music. I love listening to orchestral music. In fact, when I'm home at night, when I'm I'm up in bed reading, I'll put the classical stations on. I almost never listen to jazz at home, or even pop music at home. I'll put the classical stations on, and I just like to just listen to the sense of orchestration. A lot of beautiful things inspire me. I've been inspired by Cecil Taylor. I've been inspired by, just a lot of elements. With Charles Mingus, I'm doing a Charles Mingus project next month with the band in Cologne. So there's so many things. It's never been one thing. I'm not a traditionalist, but I know the tradition. So I love some of the hip hop things, man. I think the grooves are great. I'm not saying I'm infatuated by the lyrics all the time, but I love the grooves that they get into.
I agree.
It's great, man. I mean, I can't dance, and I can even dance to that. It's fun to kind of get up and move around. But I really love the grooves. I love that stuff.
What's cool about hip-hop is, I talked to a lot of guys that, they know that I'm a primary keyboardist, but a lot of the grooves, I hear more melodies and chords and bass lines on top of it. It kind of takes the street edge out of it, more or less cater to our band, but that's where I hear the groove is hot, the rhythm section is hot, the drums are popping, and immediately I was like, oh man, that'll be a killer synth bass lead on top of that, or put some nice B chords on top and start stacking, and man, you got one big gumbo of hip hop and jazz and R&B all mixed together.
It's great. Like sometimes, when I've been on some dates where I play keyboard, it's going back a few years, when we playing with the Steve Gadd or Rick Marotta and some of those guys, when they get into this kind of groove and you're playing that groove, man, and you're just playing that incessant groove and it gets so intense and you're really not moving away, you're not really doing anything if you were playing a jazz-oriented piece. You're just kind of staying in this groove and the thing is getting so intense. Yeah. I mean, that's fun.
It is.
Just as fun as if you're playing with an interesting jazz kind of a groove or an interesting pop groove. Kind of get in that. You get into that incessant groove, and things just getting, the repetition is getting so intense that you're having so much fun. You don't even care. You're just having so much fun. Because I work with guys like a Steve Gadd who play this one thing. He'll just keep playing it, and man, it's all of a sudden you realize, man, this thing is just burning.
Wow.
And you don't want to give it up, man.
Yes.
No, it's fun. I like that, man. You figure you're finishing, man. You're sweating, and you're like, you're really exhausted, but man, you're just playing this one thing over and over, and it's burning. That's fun. That's a lot of fun.
It is. So, Michael, what is on the musical agenda for 2010?
Whoa. Okay, there's a lot of things. I've been doing a lot of work with symphony orchestras, too, which I find exciting. In 2 weeks, I go back. We're doing a project with Gary Burton, the vibraphonist, and two tango musicians. It's a jazz tango project with the band in Cologne. And then I'm doing a Charles Mingus project, and I just finished a project with the wonderful singer Kurt Elling. And we got a a new record out with Bill Evans, saxophonist. I'm doing another project with Bill Evans and Maceo Parker next year. And a wonderful German trumpet player, Till Brunner, who was known in the States also. We're doing a project together with him. And I'm doing a project of Italian Renaissance music with the Cologne Big Band and the orchestra there, with a saxophone, Italian saxophonist, and a very interesting voice. So there's a lot of interesting things I'm doing, you know. And we did a project with Mike Stern, which I hope comes out maybe in another year and a half or so. And so, interesting. We did a nice project with Paquita Di Rivera with Symphony. So there's a lot of interesting things that I'm doing that's coming up, and working also with other bands in Europe, and doing, I also teach. I was teaching Manhattan School of Music for a number of years, jazz composition, which I still try to do when I'm home. I also have private students here and private students in Germany, and I like doing workshops with students. I really have a lot of fun going and do composition workshops and working with their big bands or their small groups. And, you know, I find that very challenging, and I find it also very fulfilling. And I learn, too. You learn from the students.
Yeah.
You really learn. So I don't tell the student how to write. I want to see what they can do. I'm not going to say you have to write like Count Basie, you know, or Ellington, or this or that. Let me hear what you got, and let's go from there. Let me hear what's going on. Let me hear what's in your mind.
Wow.
Don't tear it apart.
That's great, man. When you let the students, you know, magnify their talents and their artist expression for composition, because I think that's where a lot of students really want to get a chance to really show it as they can, especially when they're young. You know, I've been there when I was like 17, 16.
Yeah.
You know, I was a hot rodder and trying to show everybody my cool runs, and especially if you have a great teacher to, it's like, man, look what I can do, you know. So yeah, that's giving them that playtime is excellent.
Oh, it's fun. I really, and even when I've done workshops with instrumentalists and you know, just kind of, and working with keyboard players, for instance, how to comp, even, which is an art form in itself, like guys like Bill Evans and Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock are great compers, you know. Duke Ellington was a great comper, Thelonious Monk, you know, trying to fulfill that part of it. Richard Teeb was a great comper. You know, getting guys to, as a keyboard player, to figure out how you have to play behind a person. Again, it has nothing to do with genres. Just, you still got to play behind somebody.
Exactly.
So you figure how, you know, you got to lead and follow at the same time, kind of, is the concept. So you got to, you know, your mind's got to work simultaneously in both directions. So, working with that, you know, it's a lot of different things I enjoy doing. You know, I've done it in Berlin, I've done it in Germany, in Cologne, different places, in Amsterdam, in the Netherlands, all over. So it's, I'm a workaholic, let's put it that way. I get nervous, but I only got two projects to work on. You know, I get nervous, you know.
Well,
no, I'm a workaholic. I'm nuts.
Oh, well, it shows, man. It definitely shows. Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure and truly an honor having you on my show. I would love to have you back and talk about your new endeavors, you know, talk about your new production that you want to get into. I got to have you back, man. I need some more lessons.
Man, thank you. Thank you very much. It was really a lot of fun. You asked great questions, and it made me spill my guts. And thank you. Anyway, please, I would love to come back. Whenever you say, I'll show up at your door.
Oh, man, I got you, man. And, you know, have a safe 2010, man. And best luck to you.
All right, thanks a lot, Spud. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye. And a big shout out and thank you to Mr. Michael Abeni for coming on the show and chopping it up with me. Again, I love speaking to composers and keyboarders who really step outside the box for creativity, you know, exploring the possibilities of where the compositions of the song can go. And Michael's a great display and representation of, you know, taking those productions to another level. And again, you know, just to have that one-on-one time with them was truly inspirational for me. And a big shout out again to Michael. And to get more information on Michael, he does have a MySpace page at myspace.com/Michael Abeni. And the last name is spelled A-B-E-N-E. myspace.com/Michael Abeni. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit my website up at www.spud2tight.blogspot.com. Again, www.spud2tight.blogspot.com. And I also host a podcast on iTunes, so if you have an iPhone, an iPod, or a computer, open up the iTunes player, go to the iTunes store, type in the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, click on my image, and you'll have a list of my past and current interviews as well. And for the remainder of the show, I'm going to let the track that's playing in the background close off the show. And the title of the track is called Funny Face, and it's one of Michael's compositions. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening in. Until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace.